Hello, everybody. This is the Foreign Press Association. Today, we're very happy to have with us Darina Shevchenko, who's the CEO of the Kyiv Independent, which is an online English language newspaper published in, surprisingly enough, Kyiv, which covers Ukraine and the war, of course, and has got renown internationally. It was a breakaway, which Darina can explain to us, from proprietorial dominance in the former Kyiv Post when the independent journalists defected to form the Kyiv Post. So we can get into those details, but it's a timely day today because Ukraine, in an administrative sense, is in the headlines because Congresswoman Spartz, for whatever reasons, has just announced her displeasure with Zelensky and his chief of staff. We don't know if her statements so far are amazingly enough for a Republican congresswoman without substance or backing, as far as we can tell. At least, you know, there might be evidence, but she's yet to provide any of it. But to make a major argument like this about hearsay does really raise into question. The Kyiv Independent, it was its headline story this morning. And it should be, because if you're a leading politician in your biggest foreign ally decides to blow the whistle on your president and his staff, then it is news. And they've done a fairly good breakdown of what substance there is or isn't behind it. But Darina, can you explain? Well, I think the first point is, who is your audience? Is it English speakers in Ukraine? Is it people across the world? Or who are you addressing your news to?
Hi, sorry, was muted. Hi, everyone. It's a pleasure being here. Thank you for inviting me. Well, our audience is, we call it all the stakeholders of Ukraine in the world. So we basically sort of anyone who is interested in Ukraine, works with Ukraine, lived in Ukraine, left Ukraine, coming to Ukraine, lives in Ukraine temporarily, lives in Ukraine for the time being, you know, etc. So it used to be the biggest portion of our audience is abroad right now. Of course, most of the foreigners living in Ukraine left Ukraine when the war started, but those who are still in, of course, are part of our audience as well.
And in terms of coverage, you've got an acute dilemma. Obviously, you support Ukraine vis-a-vis Russia, but that means there's a lot of wiggle room to disagree. So how independent is your political line? It's certainly not my government, right or wrong. I can see that you've reported on administrative court judges, on bankruptcies and other things. So is there a dilemma between a dialectic, shall we say, between supporting the country and holding the government's feet to the fire for its conduct of the war?
We don't see it like that. We think that Ukraine can only win if it is transparent and its government and authorities work transparently and openly and they are held accountable. If they're not, you know, whatever military victory we've got, we've been failing. We'll be failing anyway, right? So it's our job as watchdogs to, you know, essentially watch both the enemy outside, but also the what's happening inside the country and make sure that everything is seen, revealed when necessary and, you know, taken care of, not by us, but the public.
And can you name any big examples recently of where you've fallen foul of the government for pointing out their failings?
I'm not editor, I'm not an editor, so I don't have a list of stories in my head. But if you look at our coverage, I think we pretty much do it all the time. Like we write critical opinions of, you know, editorials, run opinion pieces. We, you know, run stories about governmental, whatever, mischiefs. And we are not, you know, trying to hold back. But that said, I think the problem of having less stories in the media about the government and government's doings is not even in this self-censorship. It's more about the resources. Ukrainian media are not large. You know, Kyiv Independent is basically 20 people, and these 20 people mostly are busy with covering war. There are a lot of war developments. There are a lot of human stories we want to bring to the world. There are priorities. So when the war started, the full-scale invasion started, we had to prioritize war reporting over everything else. That's essential, the bottleneck for us. But as we move on, as we try to adjust to the new circumstances, we are trying to launch the investigative department to staff up, to make sure that we can cover business, tech, you know, politics in more detail than we're doing it right now. You know, on top of that, Kyiv Independent is also a startup. We are only 6 months old. So, you know, there are a lot of organizational problems at that. I can't speak to the editorial policies because I'm not the editor, but from what I know, because I'm very close to the newsroom as well, is that there is no self-censorship issue at the Kyiv Independent. Everybody is absolutely happy to watch what the authorities are doing and how they are performing, because that's also part of the, you know, Ukraine's war for its future.
I mean, there must be, there certainly is among some of the Western reporters there, the knowledge that anything they say that's at all critical will be jumped upon by the, I suppose, let us be cavalier and call them the Ork press, the Putin press, and used to attack, you know, for example, there was a recent allegation that Ukrainians were selling Western weapons, presumably to the Russians. Was unsourced, there were no evidence at all, but if it were a story, then it is one that you should cover. But if it's not sourced properly, then it is passing on rumors. What's your attitude to a story like that?
I haven't seen that they've changed the headline. So they started with claiming that Ukraine smuggles weapons, and then they changed it to there is a risk. It's not Western press's obligation to care for Ukraine's security and to care about what Russia will take and spin into a new fake story. I think in Ukraine, we believe that before running a story like that, we need to fact check it very carefully to make sure that it's not something we are throwing at our own country just for fun, like just to kind of have people thinking about stuff. If we have the evidence, then we run the story. That would be my take on it. But frankly, this is the position the Kyiv was before the Kyiv Independent, and now the Kyiv Independent had even before the war. If you don't have the evidence, don't run the story. That's very simple. And you know, it has to be even stricter during the war, but it doesn't have to change when the peace comes.
In fact, we issued a statement last week, at the end of last week, about an Associated Press report, which took a UN report that had two paragraphs about the care home in Staria, in that the Russians shelled, which said Ukraine bears most of the blame. So we analysed the story, and basically it was a complete inversion of the facts, a 49-page report, two paragraphs that mentioned the Russians had shelled the place, and it concluded that the Ukrainians must share most of the blame. And there probably was some blame, but the distortion of it is something that, inadvertent or otherwise, immediately goes around the world and gets enshrined. And I understand that you are not best friends with, the President Zelensky, although much beloved by everybody else, is not your best friend. Is this true?
Zelensky, you know, I'm sorry to say that, but Zelensky is no best friend to any journalist in Ukraine, to any independent journalist in Ukraine, at least. Unfortunately, Zelensky's authorities are not friendly with the press. They don't seem to appreciate what the press is doing for the, you know, for the freedom of the country. And they've been hostile to journalists before the war, and they've been treating journalists very badly. And, you know, they, you know, there are a lot of videos of Zelensky talking to journalists very rudely and, you know, accusing them of stuff and stuff like that. So it's no news. He's no friend.
Is this just Ukrainian journalists? Because, I mean, the thing that everybody seems to have in their heads about the president is how media savvy he is, how adept he is at presenting a public image and conveying it.
You have to understand about President Zelensky. He used to be a comedian and an actor, and a very successful one at that. And as an actor, you always receive applause and admiration. As a president, you don't. You always receive a lot of critical questions and, you know, a lot of debate around whatever you're saying or doing or how you're appearing or whatever. And Zelensky is not used to that. He doesn't like that. He wants still the applause. And when he doesn't receive the applause, he gets very irritated and angry and stuff like that. And, you know, he tends to be offended at journalists and not speak to a certain editorial office for some reason. We recently met our colleagues at BBC, and they said that he wouldn't respond to their interview request for 5 months since the war started, because he didn't like himself in his previous appearance at BBC. So that's pretty much how he acts. Of course, he appears friendly now, and I should say, I mean, he stepped up his game as, you know, as a media persona, and he started communicating much better, in my opinion. I think he had some staff changes in his communication office as well, and all that is, for you know, happening and is appreciated by everybody, journalists included. But I don't see him being a friend of Free Press, unfortunately, neither him or his office.
So he hasn't given you the big sit-down interview yet.
I know.
It's an interesting contrast between the international appearance and the local perspective. But I suppose he feels he needs international support more than he needs local support at the moment.
Yeah, I think his idea was, you know, he kind of was elected through this massive support of people. That is the biggest support for a president elected in Ukraine since the independence. And I think it's the biggest, at least. And he ran his campaign essentially through social media. And I think he believes that he can surpass media, traditional media companies in his communications. When the war started, he kind of realized that he can't. And he kind of started being more open, but there is no reason for me personally to believe that he changed his strategy.
Well, is this partly a consequence of the nature of the media? Is the Ukrainian media like in many other parts of the former Soviet space, under the control of various robbers and oligarchs, or, you know, is it genuinely independent?
So it's complicated. Ukrainian media market is very distorted, but it's mostly distorted and remains so in the TV part of it. So we almost don't have independent TV channels. Most of them are owned by oligarchs. Very wealthy people with political ambitions or connections or, you know, affiliations. And, you know, they're just kind of their own thing. They have a lot of money. They produce a lot of entertainment content. Based on that, they attract a lot of audiences. Up until recent years, the news consumption reports about Ukraine showed that 80 or even 90% in the early years of people consumed news from TV. So it was the most influential platform. Thankfully, as the internet developed, people started switching in their news consumption to the internet. And I think the TV news consumption dropped to almost 50%. So it kind of made space for internet media to appear. And then in the internet, it's pretty easy to establish an independent operation, media operation. You don't have, Ukraine is pretty easy on the media registration laws. We don't have to get any licenses or anything. You essentially can start a website and work. Well, that's basically the case of the Kyiv Independent. We are not registered as a media company and we don't have to be.
Does that mean you don't get the protection, the implied protections of press?
According to the Ukrainian law, media are protected within the laws that protect pretty much every human. There are a couple clauses that suggest that a media request can be prioritized or something like that, and a couple of clauses about protecting journalists. But it doesn't depend on the licensing. It depends on your actual, what you actually do. You don't have to have an official press ID. It can be a press ID issued by your company, and that's enough. And you will be considered a journalist. So what I was basically saying is that a lot of independent media appeared. They were supported by donors, which kind of also distorted the market a little bit financially, because this media, can develop a lot, are often not sustainable because they only rely on donor funding. But that said, they are independent and they are influential. So there are a lot of influential independent media in Ukraine, both investigative teams and general, news teams in English, Russian, Ukrainian. There is a diversity of media. And I have to say that the war shows that Ukrainian media is essentially a firepower. And I'm very proud to say that, because when I started working in media 12 years ago, there were essentially four or five independent media in Ukraine in general. And two of them were Radio Liberty and BBC. So three, and that's it. Now we have dozens and dozens of independent media of different size, influence. They are hyper-local, local, regional, national, different platforms, different types of products. There are a lot of independent media and they have influence, and they mostly, they are mostly what the politicians are afraid of.
Do any of them actually support Putin or suggest that maybe Ukraine should have been nicer to the Russians and avoided the war? Or are they all pretty much patriotic on this?
No, I think if there were some, they already killed themselves. And I don't know of any independent media, or actually independent media these days, that suggest these things. That would be weird. That I could say that would be dangerous nowadays in Ukraine.
Well, as some pro-Russian politicians have been arrested, haven't they? So are they allowed? I mean, is it allowed? What's the boundary here between, how should we say, recognizable dissidents and treachery in the face of the enemy?
I mean, we are in an active phase of war, and there is an actual enemy who is firing missiles at our cities, thousands and thousands of people dying and suffering every day, and tortured every day, and displaced, millions of Ukrainians are displaced. If you are a supporter of that, you are essentially an enemy and should be treated like an enemy. Well, I don't see what's dissident about supporting a murderer.
No. We could, well, for example, I mean, one of the contentious issues at the moment, which is, that's got shades of grey, is the question of Russian language teaching. And I see that in the Rada, there are people trying, I mean, there's a, I think you're covering it. There are current attempts to make Ukrainian language proficiency a qualification for citizenship. Now, so how contentious an issue is that? Because I know.
Well, why shouldn't it be? Like, well, can you get American citizenship without knowing English?
Yes, as a matter of fact. Several million Spanish out of the window here in Harlem could say the same thing. And I come from Britain, where people speak Welsh, for example.
No, but like,
and it's accepted. It's accepted that this is perfectly natural.
But you need to have some kind of level of English that you can communicate at, right? So you.
No. You can get British citizenship on the basis of Welsh or Irish or Scots Gaelic.
No, but that's still, you know, that's still understandable. You know, that's still the language. I mean.
I think the point is, you've got people who are born in Ukraine and entitled to Ukrainian citizenship that way. Is there any attempt to restrict that citizenship on the basis?
No. It's not about that. It's about it's about making sure that everyone in Ukraine speaks enough Ukrainian to, you know, take care of their paperwork, for example, or, you know, I don't know, shop or get on the public transport. And
I just renewed my British driving license, and I could have filled out the whole procedure in Welsh and got my driving license in Welsh with no problems whatsoever, no disabilities. So it's
Great Britain is still kind of an empire. It's, you know, it's a combination of several countries. It's not the case in Ukraine. Ukraine is Ukraine. There are no, you know, other parts of other countries attached to it. You know, even if Russians want to spin it, it's not. And then nobody's prohibiting Russian language, right? You can still use it. You won't be deported if we hear you speak Russian. More than that, I mean, we have mostly Ukrainian staff at the Kyiv Independent, and many in our newsroom speak Russian, and that's fine. I mean, but they also all speak Ukrainian. Ukrainian has only been the state language. We never had Russian as a state language. I don't know what's all the fuss about. And, you know, what surprises me is that this Russian language issue is something Russians have been trying to spin around for so many years, centuries even. They've devoted so much resources to kill Ukrainian language in its existence before the independence in the Soviet Union, and then after the independence through their, you know, investing in the old Russian language products and stuff like that. And now suddenly that Ukraine starts taking steps to preserve its language, everybody's worried that something will happen to Russian speakers. Well, no, it's, you know, it's the same as saying, you know, this feminists are trying to get this, you know, women's rights protected, let's protect men, because they're, you know, they are the vulnerable ones. That's, you know, that's not what's happening. What's happening is that Russian, Ukrainian language has been oppressed. And Russian language speakers are not threatened in any way in Ukraine, and they won't be, because Ukraine is a free country and you can speak whatever language you want. But, you know, I don't know why everybody's concerned about that, especially looking and seeing.
In most of Europe, it's a very sensitive issue of language rights. And especially since in this context, the Russians in Ukraine are a minority, the Russian speakers. I mean, it's shown, for example, the fact that the Russians put most of their missiles into the Russian-speaking areas in the Donbass suggests that their concern for Russian speakers is somewhat exaggerated.
It's artificial. And first of all, Russian speakers in Ukraine haven't been a minority for over 20 years. They are only becoming slightly minor than Ukrainian speakers right now. And this is, you know, this is also one of the legends spread by Russian that, you know, it's a suppressed minority. It's not. Most of the people spoke Russian in Ukraine just like a few years ago. It started shifted maybe 8 years ago in 2014 after the Revolution of Dignity. And there is a huge shift right now when people just don't want
obviously,
to
yes. any
language. And that's, you know, kind of fair enough, right? So, but it's never been a suppressed minority. It's a very twisted reality that, you know, Russians are spreading, and unfortunately, you know, our colleagues in the West are picking up and, you know, treating with all seriousness. Like, you are actually asking me, you know, whether there is a threat for Russian speakers. Well, no. And, you know, I didn't even know that you guys would seriously ask the question, because for us here, it's so obvious that this is a manipulation.
Well, I've noticed that from speaking to Ukrainians, that I don't think they realize the sensitivity of this issue for many other people who don't necessarily buy the Russian propaganda. But it is a niche, and I think maybe you should be aware of how it looks from the outside, even from people who totally support Ukraine's struggle to maintain independence. Just as a thought, I mean, I live across the sea from Ireland, and the Irish are notoriously patriotic and independent and nationalist, but they're nationalist and independent in English most of the time. They feel no disability. Very few people actually speak Irish, but it's quite possible to be patriotic in another language. Is the point?
Yeah, we've been patriotic in different languages for a long time, and nobody's suppressing anyone. But if you're even asking this question, you are buying Russian propaganda. That's the essence of Russian propaganda. The fact that you think that the Russian language issue isn't even an issue in Ukraine.
Well, you know, your parliament, it was being raised in your parliament recently about citizenship tests. So it is an issue. I didn't raise it. You raised it. You said that.
But we don't see an issue about it. We think that this is a natural process.
Well, there's been a petition to the president about it at the moment.
We believe that you
reported on it.
In Ukraine, anybody can start a petition. You can if you want. It doesn't say that.
Okay.
It doesn't say that the majority of Ukrainians see it as an issue. But you know.
No, I'm sure the majority of Ukrainians don't see it as an issue. Other people do, and the Russians are exploiting that niche.
That's my point. Russians are exploiting something that they want to exploit, and they've been doing it not just with the Russian language. They've been saying that Ukrainians, you know, Ukrainian nation doesn't exist, that Ukrainian language doesn't exist, that it's a dialect of Russian, and they're saying a lot of things. But we, you know, why buy into this one? Just because there are issues that you
have. No, you don't have to buy into it. There are aspects that need considering. But I mean, it's not my purpose to discuss Russian language policy. We're discussing, do you do a Russian edition? Does anybody do Russian editions addressing the Russians about what their government is doing in Ukraine?
Well, do you think Russians don't know what their government is doing?
Well, according to our reports from here, 80% of them, the only version they get is the Russian state media, which they would not have a clue what's happening. They're looking at pictures of devastated Ukrainian cities and seeing improvements.
First of all, that's a very weird understanding of what they do and don't have a clue. They do have a clue about the atrocities Russia's committing, and they do have a clue about the war Russia is waging on Ukraine. They do know from even the Russian state media that Russia is bombing cities. And you know what? They're fine with it. 80% of, you know, Russians are fine with the war, support the war. And there are multiple reports about it. So, you know, we've been trying to work with Russians, include them in our audiences. There were multiple Russian language editions of, you know, different media. There are still some, a very powerful one in Ukraine. So if they want to read them, they're free to read them. But the problem with that is there are also, you know, there's supposedly a lot of Russian independent media who are supposed, whose job it is to open Russians' eyes at what the state is doing. But it seems
whose main task at the moment is to stay out of jail because they didn't say anything.
I'm sorry to say that, but they had 30 years to fight it off. And they've been complying with every other authoritarian law you know, put on them. They've been, you know, posting the statements. They haven't been protesting it enough. They complied with the deaths of their own. And, you know, now they their only job is to stay out of jail. And then our job is to open their audiences.
We've interviewed Russian journalists who've had to flee. So we know, we're aware of just the constraints that they have. And, you know, what stands out is that Ukraine, and what you're testifying, does have a free press. Russia doesn't. So, you know, I think some tolerance for the ones who are suffering in Russia.
But whose problem is that? You know, do you think that free press just appeared in Ukraine, or civil society just appeared in Ukraine, or was granted to Ukraine, and it was some magical gods, you know, sitting on the cloud and saying, let's make Russia authoritarian and Ukraine?
No, I was watching with interest the struggle for a free press in there and everywhere else across the region. I have been for many years since the breakdown of the Soviet Union, independent journalists
Ukrainians
have tried
to work hard for the free press to appear. I work in the media for 12 years, and 5 or 7 years out of those, I work in media development, and I created multiple programs to essentially boost the development of Ukrainian independent media. I personally did a lot for this to happen. And then now, you know, Russian civil society and Russian independent media failed at that. They had 30 years, you know, they came to this not in 1 year or 5 years. They've been coming to this for 30 years, same amount of time we had to build a democratic country, but they didn't. They complied and complied and complied, and now their only, you know, job is to stay out of jail. Well, it's not. You know, if you ask me, now you can even, I don't know, whatever, you know, now they're pretty much useless. And then
they're in the position of, the idea is if you put frogs in a pan and start boiling the water, they don't get it. By the time they realize how hot it is, it's too late.
Yeah. And then now, you know, what happens now is that you are asking me a question. Do you even have Russian editions to open eyes of the Russians? Well, it's not our job. And if you ask me, it's too late. I don't think anyone can open the eyes of the Russians. That said, we do have a project, by the way, a new one launched recently that is targeting Russian speakers, but not in Russia, more like all over the world, to give them news analytics and, you know.
I see the Ukrainian Ministry of Information, and I can see that they are actually actively working on these things. I have a slightly more expansive view. What do you think of the Western coverage of the war in Ukraine? I mean, are they distorting it? Is Zelensky as Superman, or as ancient ethnic hatreds, or all of the other tropes that the Western media sometimes comes out with?
I think they are distorting it, but I don't think that there is a huge problem with that. I think there was a lot of helpful coverage. There is a bit of distortion, and we're going around and talking to people about it, about, you know, making Zelensky a hero, but because that it's more than just an issue of over exaggerating Zelensky's thing. It's adding to his power that we're afraid will have hard time at letting go, you know, at the end. But at this point, I don't think there is a huge problem with assertion. I think the main problem is that Western coverage usually doesn't have enough context, for example, and it creates, and it often takes these legends and fakes spread by Russia and gives it a spin, some kind of, you know, this Western flavor, and then sells it further as truth. For example, there is this Russian language situation, or there is, you know, Azov battalion depict as Nazis. And I recently talked to an Italian journalist, and she asked me, like, but this Nazi group, they're like fighting there in the east. Like, what do you mean group? They're like they're a combat unit of Ukrainian army. They're not a group, do you? And she's like, wait a second, but they're like Nazis. And like, well, first of all, I'm pretty sure there are a couple of right-wing participants, you know, members of that unit that, you know, were highlighted by the way Western journalists, and, you know, brought to the light, and it just was exaggerated to the point where the whole unit's in Nazi, though it's not. and it's an official combat unit of the Ukrainian army. It's like, it's not a gang with, you know, the guns that is running around. It's an army unit. She was very surprised to hear that. She didn't know that. She thought that it was actually a gang just kind of, you know, running around and helping Ukrainian.
Well, I have to say that's been one of the Kremlin's biggest successes, is that they've got this figment of the Azov Brigade, Azov Battalion. I mean, on the internet, I basically tend to take the mickey out of people, because if in doubt, say Azov Brigade, and that's supposed to finish the argument for them, because they have it firmly established in the West. The Azov Brigade are all neo-Nazis, goose-stepping, yeah. And I said, you know, excuse me, Jewish president, Nazis, do you see any disconnect there? No, they don't, because people like this can believe two impossible things at the same time.
I think that's the main problem with the Western coverage, that they don't know enough context and they don't know enough understanding of what's happening. For example, like this nationalism issue is also something that has to be explained in, there's context, you know, nationalism in Ukraine has been fighting for its independence for decades, literally. And guess against who? Well, mostly against Russia. So Ukrainian nationalism is mostly about leave us alone.
I've just seen recently that it was Stefan Bandera who invented the term orcs for the Russians. I never knew that he wrote The Lord of the Rings, but apparently he did. This man was a towering genius.
There was even the funniest story. I saw Russian, some hyper-local news sites running a headline that the Russian military is looking for Stepan Bandera, actually. Like, they actually think that he's alive. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there are a lot of funny stories about that, but what's not funny is how the truth, you know, how random facts are taken out of context, supported by Russian fakes, and then spinned into, you know, this Western stories, like Azov Battalion, like Russian language issue, like, you know, whatever. Like, I think that's the problem. I have to say that I'm grateful for the coverage that Western media did this last few months and for all the resources they put into it. I know that a lot of them deployed like big teams for a long period of time to Ukraine to make sure that they cover on the ground. A lot contacted us and asked for help. And, you know, we would never decline a live interview or, you know, to connect with a journalist if we have resources. We didn't miss the email because it's going crazy at times, but because we also think that it is very important that Western media talk about Ukraine, because as soon as they stop talking about Ukraine, you know, our victory comes at a much higher price, and yes, we already paid a very high price and we can't take more. Probably Ukrainians will never stop fighting, but the price we're paying will be growing progressively to, you know, the attention fall.
I mean, frankly, I was pleasantly surprised that much of the sort of the left and liberal press here has it's often instinctively pro-Russian on the grounds that they're against Washington. But it's amazing how many of them actually came to the defense of Ukraine when it started. I am sort of, you know, pleasantly surprised by the degree of support for Ukraine in areas which have been well imbued with Russian propaganda for many years. But I'm also a bit disturbed by women like this congressman, and that quite where the Trump section comes from, and what they have against Ukraine and what they have in favor of Russian, apart from big checks in rubles from oligarchs.
Well, that's also, you know, part of the problem with Western support is that, you know, the congresswoman is just basically the far end of this problem, right? So the problem essentially is that the world is supporting Ukraine. It seems like the world is like, go Ukraine, win this war, you know, but then some, you know, as it goes in the sport competition, some can bring you some water, you know, help you out, help you not fall. Some will just go like, you go, girl. And then the problem is that the world doesn't seem to understand to the fullest that this war is not just Ukraine's war, that this war is not, you know, well, it's your problem, guys, win it or don't win it, we don't care. Ukraine is one of the biggest importers of grains and a lot of other stuff to the world. And what's happening in Ukraine will lead to a huge food crisis very soon. And the fact, you know, that people don't understand me is threatening, don't understand it is threatening. And, you know, I even heard something like, well, I want peace, whatever kind of peace. Maybe Ukraine should make concessions, you know, and like have this peace cooked up, and then like, and then happens what, I ask, like, and then you think that Russia will be dealing with you in good faith or something?
This
or
is like what Macron was saying. I mean, I've never believed this weird idea that negotiations in themselves solve anything.
Well, yeah, but because you're negotiating with a murderer, like, so it's same as saying like, okay, you kill this like dozen people in a horrible way, but then let's agree to share a room, and then, but you will stay on your side of the room and I will stay in mine, and we won't, you know, interact except for like, this is your soul, this is my brand, you know. It doesn't work like that. You're negotiating with a terrorist state, and they won't be dealing in good faith. They won't be, you know, taking steps to make amends with you guys, even not with us. And then what happens to Ukraine? It's a huge European country, you know, it's the center of Europe. Like, what about like people suffering there? They'll keep torturing us. We'll be just what, flying around Ukraine for the rest of the war? I don't know. I don't understand this. And the congresswoman is essentially, you know, she basically spoke what a lot of people thought, maybe not that, but still. What she said is, you know what? It's your war, guys, and you're not working hard enough, because I've seen some people having a glass of wine in Kyiv, and you don't have a war, you know? And this is a very weird perspective for a politician, but also for Ukrainian. From what I know, she lived in Ukraine for, what, 20 years, 22 years? She studied in Ukrainian university even. And she doesn't speak the language. She refers to our country as your country and my country, which is, I guess, the US. And, you know, she just surprised me. It just surprised me a lot how...
We see a lot more Republicans like this than you do, so it's not as surprising that it's, as you think. But their ability to believe two impossible things simultaneously is rapidly becoming legendary. But Simon has just made a point about, you know, the Western Europe, the countries that support Ukraine, what about the other countries that we would have traditionally expected to stand up against an imperialist power like Russia, but India, Brazil, and Mexico. There are a lot of countries out there that don't seem to be convinced about Ukraine. The Russians have worked on them in some way or another. So they're not pro-Russian, but they're sort of basically act in the international forum as though they don't have a dog in the fight.
Frankly, Ukraine is very focused on Ukraine right now, and, you know, and Russia. I don't think anyone, I don't see a lot of attention to other players and Russia supporters in the media space. I've recently only realized that most of the Africa are pro-Russian, even then, though they're dependent on Ukrainian grains as well. But that, you know, I don't want to be ignorant about it, but it's also a problem of resources and not being able to pay attention to that, because there is a huge issue we have with this Russia situation, you know, like the wars, the shelling, the humanitarian catastrophes in our city and stuff like that. I don't think that anyone is paying enough attention. I didn't hear about a lot of diplomatic efforts, or at least they haven't been public, to deliver the truth to these other players. But again, I'm not a specialist in that. I haven't been following that very closely. So I don't think I'm very competent to comment on that.
Yeah. sorry, my throat is... David Bloom wants to know, what does Ukraine need the most from the United States now? Is it diplomatic support, military support, financial support, or putting truth in the sanctions, putting the squeeze on Europeans to stop pumping dollars into the Kremlin treasury?
Okay, I'm not the president and I'm not the government, but from what I understand, Ukraine needs the weapons, and we need as many weapons as we can receive, and you know, we should stop receiving them after we say, please stop, we have enough. And well, but essentially that's true. We are against this huge army that is, you know, attacking us with all its force. There are reports, you know, that they might again try to go for Kyiv, and we have to be protected. We also have to liberate the territories they've been taking, because people are literally being tortured there as we speak. And I'm pretty sure that's the main help we need. But also all the diplomatic efforts, all the sanctions are very helping very much. I also hope that, you know, we'll be able, together with our Western colleagues, to keep the attention up, to make sure that the world keeps talking about Ukraine, because the war fatigue is settling in and it's inevitable. We've seen it in 2014, but we can't have it. We need to have to keep the attention high. So I would ask for this help as well. Make sure that you talk to your editors, you know, you run opinions somewhere in your publications, or post on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, you know, about what's happening in Ukraine. Please use the Kyiv Independent as your news source, repost our stories, or just write something that, you know, just make sure it's in the information space. I think that's very important.
What about some countries in the West seem to have a sort of imposing a limit, their reluctance to supply weapons to Ukraine that could hit Russian territory? Now, I work on the principle that if the Russians can fly from Belarus and bomb Ukraine, and and the Russians can send missiles from across the Caspian Sea into Ukraine, then really there's no point in us putting any moral limits on Ukrainians fighting back. There are expedient limits about whether you want to provoke the bear. That's another story. But is that much of a debate in Ukraine about whether taking the war into the Russian heartland?
In Ukraine, everybody agrees with you on that particular issue. I don't understand why there should be a discussion about it. So, like, it's acceptable for Russia to hit our territory, but it's a problem if Ukraine responds. Like,
how also, you're nice guys. I mean, you haven't and you don't want, despite what they say, to shell cities and civilians and to bomb, you know,
we are nice guys, but there won't be a lot of these nice guys left if we don't do that very soon. So there is that situation. And I think, you know, I think that it's important to understand that this war in Ukraine, that Russia waged on Ukraine, and by the way, somebody asked if Russia will stop in the East. Of course, no. Who are you kidding? I mean, if they take over Ukraine, they'll take over Baltics, and then, you know, let's see what comes next. And that will be the whole different world, and you won't like it. You know, if you don't know much about Russians, well, just trust me on this one, you won't like it. And, you know,
the Baltics seem to be well aware of that. They're all introducing conscription, and
they are well aware of that. And you know, like, this war changed the world security system already. It's failing. It's already failing. And it will you know, as this war drags on, it will fail more and more. And sooner or later, one way or another, the world will have to come to a new security system. The one, for example, where it won't be a discussion whether the country attacked should have a right to attack back. Because that's just crazy. As many other things, frankly speaking. And, you know, there has to be something new out there. There has to be minds put together to solve this, because this is a failure and, you know, it doesn't work.
Have you had any reporters in or about Transnistria, which some people think could be a possible flashpoint one way or the other? If the Ukrainians say, we don't want those Russians stabbing us in the back and we'll go and help the Moldovans clear them out, or vice versa?
I mean, frankly, I don't want to just blah, blah about these military possibilities. I'm not an expert and I don't like when people do that. I guess that's the possibility, but I don't know, frankly, you know, something that can happen. If you look at the map and see how many these kind of contested territories Russia left, as you know, it waged wars on countries that were, by the way, ignored by the world, and then left these territories in this limbo state, and these territories are actually affecting the war in Ukraine now a lot.
It appears that since the war on Putin, almost any part of the former Soviet Union is now a contested territory as far as Moscow is concerned. It's all theirs, really.
So we have a question, another one. I've seen different...
You did answer it before, but we want to answer it in more detail now about different estimates on how many Russians in Russia fully oppose what their country is doing in Ukraine. What percentage would you estimate of Russians oppose their government's policy, publicly or not?
I answered it before, but you can Google it. I think there are famous reports of this. There were surveys in Russia, they're kind of, you know, official stuff, and I think it's either over 70 or even over 80% of Russians who support Russia's military invasion of Ukraine. And, you know, yeah.
But how accurate is polling in Russia if you think the FSB is going to knock on the door right after the questionnaire comes?
I don't think that, you know, you can look at this report. I think many of them are pretty credible. But even if they're not, you know, if the numbers are slightly less horrifying, they are not even 50-50.
Yeah, I mean, some intrepid reporters have gone into Russia and done vox pops with people and asked them. And it's interesting to see their reactions. A lot of people just don't want to answer the question one way or the other. And the others are obviously thinking very carefully and looking over their shoulders as they answer. So one doesn't get the impression of spontaneous effusions of support.
Well, frankly, even if like 50% of them wholeheartedly support the war, and then 30% are afraid to answer, and then the rest of them, you know, hate the war but still live in Russia and pay the taxes there, for all I know, they are all war supporters, because part of them actually support it. The other part of them are just too afraid to do something about it. And, you know, we have to pay for their fear and not them. And then the other 20%, well, they hate it. They understand everything about it, but they still do nothing. So, you know, they are basically complying with the situation. And, you know, I don't want to, or you know what, I do want to sound very aggressive about Russians, because they, you know, they had a lot of talented people and a lot of resources, and they could fight it off. They just didn't. And then I was a Ukrainian, and you know, my country is now paying for that. You know, they are as much to blame for this war as Putin. And by the way, the narrative that is very widespread is calling the war in Ukraine Putin's war. Well, it's not Putin's war, it's Russia's war. Is widely supported by Russians, and you know, or it's widely accepted by Russians if you want.
But so was the American war in Iraq, which everybody now agrees was a total disaster. In fact, the American war in Vietnam.
I, I'm sorry to say that, but it's not like, you know, I want to praise Americans for this war or anything. You guys also supported it and, you know, didn't get rid of the authorities who supported it, and that's a problem.
Okay, as long as we bear in mind that the stick points both ways. We're coming towards the end now, and I have to thank you for a free-ranging and informative discussion, and I hope we can keep in touch. And if you look at our website, feel free to use any of our product on your site. We have annual weekly briefings near enough on all sorts of issues, including Ukraine. Feel free to lift anything if you have an empty space. So thank you, Simon, for standing in there on the side. Thank you, Darina Shevchenko. This is Ian Williams from the Foreign Press Association in New York, about to croak with the pollen count. But I can live with this compared with what people in Kiev are having to put up with. But thank you very much, Darina.
Thank you, Ian. It was a pleasure meeting you, Simon.